It's Monday, October 28, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The weekend edition of USA Today said it all in its lead headline, Selling Sex. Has showbiz pressure gone too far? By asking the question, USA Today answered the question, and it answered the question conclusively. When you have a secular newspaper ask a question like this in such a moral context on its front page, the answer is axiomatic. But what makes this story really interesting is that USA Today basically tells us that we haven't seen anything yet. Ann Oldenburg and Arianne Thompson, the reporters on this story for USA Today, go into detail I will not follow. Nonetheless, they do make the point very clearly. Young Hollywood stars, they say, seem to have hit a new low. Why are they suddenly so oversexed, so determined to show all, so proud of parading around naked? One answer, because they want to. Another, survival. That's a very interesting point. These two reporters for USA Today make the point that in order right now to survive in Hollywood, you have to become a scandal, especially if you are a young female entertainer or actress, in order to stay in the celebrity headlines, which is, after all, the currency of how money is made, brands are achieved, and superstar status is aimed. What you have here is a very clear statement that if you are not a scandal, you become no one. This tells us a great deal about our culture. It's very easy for conservative Christians looking at a story like this to say, there goes the culture again. There it is, the culture out there. But we need to recognize that to some extent, anyone who's active in this culture in terms of acting as a consumer of entertainment is basically a part of this very same moral equation. The survival these two reporters are talking about is Darwinian, in a sense, the survival of the fittest. As they explain, being a dirty girl seems to be the newest movement in our pop culture evolution, as many of the hottest stars of the moment are upping the sexual ante. They then go into detail that I cannot follow. But what you're talking about here is something you do not need explicit detail to understand. You've seen the larger picture. Several persons whose very aim is to have their name mentioned, I will not mention here by name, but you know what we're talking about. And this is where we have to understand that there is an effect, not only in terms of the Hollywood financial equation, there is an effect on our families and on our young people and on ourselves. USA Today describes that the new normal in Hollywood is what is described as soft porn. If that doesn't alarm you, you need to see exactly what USA is talking about. Paris Hilton, once in the headlines herself for just this kind of activity, said, quote, every pop star wants to look sexy, end quote. What does that now require? It requires more and more transgression, more and more exposure, more and more explicitly pornographic context. On the other hand, some will remember Charlotte Church, a young girl who became very famous as a singer, a British singing sensation. She's now 27 years old. During a BBC-sponsored lecture last week, she said that young pop stars today are, in her words, quote, encouraged to present themselves as hypersexualized, unrealistic, cartoonish, as objects, reducing female sexuality to a prize you can win. In very personal terms, she spoke about the fact that when she was extremely young, her handlers wanted her to look non-sexualized, but as soon as she achieved adolescence, they wanted to take advantage of her, and this she did not allow. Britney Spears is now 31. When she was a teenager and a young woman, she helped to up the ante, to use the language of this article. She says she still feels pressure to turn up the heat. Many will remember actress Suzanne Summers. She's now 66. She was once known as a sexualized actress herself. She spoke up in defense of some of the younger actresses, one in particular, a young star that has been in the headlines for this kind of sensationalized sexuality. She defended her saying, quote, she's just young. I'm actually admiring what she's doing. Her brand is sex, drugs, rock and roll. That's where she wants to go, end quote. So in other words, morality here is just reduced to a brand, or in this case, immorality, or perhaps amorality, is just a matter of marketing in Hollywood. You know that. We all know that. It is rarely so explicitly admitted in a context like a front page news story in USA Today. One young actress who now says that she had acted in very sexualized ways because of pressure from the Hollywood marketplace said, I took off my clothes in movies, I posed nude, I did all the things that others are doing now, and I did it to continue working, to hold people's interest in what I was doing. One of the most interesting admissions in this article is the fact that much of what's going on right now in Hollywood and in the entertainment business writ large is explicitly pornographic. It is exactly the kinds of depictions of sexuality that once were sold as pornography. They're now being sold as mainstream entertainment. And the people who are featured in these are often very, very young. Indeed, those who are barely legally able so to be involved. What you have here also is, even from a statement inside the industry, that it is a matter not only of the fact that much of this is being pornified, but that much of it is also being infected by stripper culture. What you have now is an expectation on the part of those who are consuming this kind of entertainment that there will be a further crossing of the line, a further pressing of the boundary. The word used amongst philosophers and sociologists about this is transgression. And the more transgressive you are in Hollywood right now, if you're a young woman, the more likely you are to be a brand name. The more likely you are to get your name in the headlines, the more likely you are to sell your product. And as this article makes so sadly clear, the product is you. Just in case this doesn't alarm you enough, the very last sentence in the article is this. And, as one insider said, quote, "You think this is bad? Wait till 10 years from now," end quote. That article, as I said, appeared in the weekend edition of USA Today. Just a few days previous, a very similar article had appeared by Alex Williams in the Over column in the New York Times. He wrote about sex videos amongst these same young actresses and entertainers, and he wrote about the fact, as he said, quote, "In an era of celebrity oversharing, reality television, red carpet wardrobe malfunctions, drunken tweets, as well as a gradual mainstreaming of pornography, the everyday celebrity sex video is now generally greeted with a collective yawn." The words there that are so crucial is what you find is a parallel to the USA Today article. In his words, quote, "a gradual mainstreaming of pornography," end quote. You know, in one sense, perhaps we've reached a very strange and ominous cultural moment. In one sense, it is at least a moral achievement for a culture to know what pornography is in terms of a distinction against other forms of literature and entertainment. A society that intentionally blurs that distinction is not moving towards moral progress, but moral regress. We're actually trying to unlearn moral habits and convictions that all previous generations had. What we're looking at here is the progressive pornification of the culture, which means at the same time, axiomatically and of necessity, a moral defining down of the basic ethical standards of the entire society. When you have a mainstreaming of stripper culture and pornography, what you have is a marginalization of all moral conscience that cries out that something here, anything here, is horribly wrong. Also going into the weekend, Leonard Sachs, a psychologist who writes with an uncommon common sense, wrote in the pages of the Wall Street Journal that the persons most to blame for the sexting culture in America are not the kids involved, but their parents. Sachs writes about a situation in a state where you had two boys and a girl involved in a controversy over sexting. The girl had taken an explicit photograph, sent it to one boy. He said he wouldn't share it. He didn't mean to share it. Another boy got it. He put it out publicly. There is a great controversy, and of course, there needs to be. But coming in the aftermath of that, Leonard Sachs asked the question, who was to blame in this situation? He writes, "Not Emily in my judgment, not Justin, not even Brett. They're just kids. I blame their parents. The parents provided their kids with cell phones capable of taking, sending, and receiving photographs, but they provided no oversight." Sachs goes on to write, "I go around the country talking about this issue, and I'm always surprised when parents express reluctance about deploying software to monitor all the devices their children use. There are widely available programs such as My Mobile Watchdog, Mobile Spy, and NetNanny Mobile that send any photograph your child takes or receives on her phone immediately to your phone and laptop, even before your child has sent the photo anywhere. If Emily's parents," he writes, "had had such a software installed on her phone, she might not have taken the photos in the first place, since she could have explained to Justin that her parents could see all of her pictures and that any such photo would get her into deep trouble." As I said, Leonard Sachs often writes with uncommon common sense, especially coming in a secular context. And what we have here is undeniable common sense. It's so sensical that it's insane that this isn't common sense. And it is inexplicable that Christian parents in particular would not take advantage of the very kinds of monitoring software for their kids' electronic devices that are mentioned by Sachs so explicitly in this article. He's making a very good point. Now, he may overstate his case. I do not believe that the children are not responsible in this case. They are responsible. But what I do agree with Leonard Sachs about is this. Their parents are even more responsible. These kids would not have access to these digital devices if their parents did not allow it and facilitate it, and in almost every conceivable case at these ages, pay for it. And yet parents are abdicating their responsibility. One of the things that is also very clear in this article is that law enforcement officials are also as perplexed as this secular psychologist with the inattentiveness of so many parents to the digital lives of their adolescent children. He explains about the case in Lakeland, Florida, where a young girl committed suicide after she was bullied, a victim of cyberbullying. He mentions that at a news conference, the sheriff in that county, Polk County, Florida, explained that he felt he needed to act quickly in arresting the two girls who had been involved because the parents were incompetent. He then asked this question, why does she even have such a device? Parents who, instead of taking that device and smashing it into 1,000 pieces in front of that child, say that her account was hacked. The sheriff said, quote, watch what your children do online. Pay attention. Quit being their best friend and be their best parent, end quote. That's not coming from the pastor of the First Baptist Church. That is coming from the sheriff of Polk County, Florida, dealing with a dead middle school student and two other middle school students now arrested with a felony charge of cyberbullying. The most horrible part of this, of course, is the death of this young girl. But coming behind that horror is the horror of parents, the parents of the two girls who were arrested, who are, in the declaration of the very sheriff of this county, absolutely incompetent as parents. Because even after the girl committed suicide, they refused to take any action. The sheriff had the obvious response, first of all, smash that phone into 1,000 pieces. But instead, these parents simply claim that their daughter's accounts have been hacked, something no one in law enforcement is even taking seriously as an excuse. More common sense comes from Leonard Sachs as he concludes this article. He says, I'm not saying it's easy. There is no analog in our own upbringing, but I'm amazed at how parents push back, especially affluent parents, who tell me they don't want to violate their child's privacy. Here's what I tell him, writes the psychologist. The most important thing you can teach your children about technology is that there is no privacy online. You must teach your kids that they should not send any photo to a friend's cell phone or post anything on social media unless they are prepared for the whole world to see it. The best way, he says, to teach that message is not to preach it, but to enforce it, to let your child know that you will see every photo they take. That's also, I would say, where we inculcate a sense of accountability and what just about any generation would have called moral common sense. Similarly, going into the weekend, the Associated Press ran another article. The Denver Post ran it. It's by Ann Flaherty on cyberbullying. As she writes, cyberbullying still persists. A new poll shows that teens are more willing than in the past to speak up. And here's another word that encourages, indeed even underlines, the role of parents. Flaherty writes that a poll released Thursday of last week by the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, also in cooperation with MTV, found that incidents of so-called digital abuse are still prevalent, but are at least now declining, if only slightly so. It did find a growing awareness among teenagers and young adults about harm from online meanness and cyberbullying. There's also an increase amongst those willing to tell a parent or a sibling. Here's what's really interesting. 49% of all teenagers and young adults say they've had at least one brush with electronic harassment. And of those who've encountered an incident, 34% went to a parent, compared with 27% just 2 years ago. And when asked what helped, 72% of those encountering digital abuse said they changed their email, screen name, or cell number. 66% said talking to a parent. That's very, very interesting. In other words, as teenagers are beginning to understand the danger involved in this kind of cyberbullying and digital activity, an increased percentage are actually going to parents. What does that tell you? They know perhaps what their parents are not yet acknowledging. This is a dangerous world. When a teenager goes to a parent in a situation like this, the teenager is saying, in effect to the parent, you did not protect me in a way I had expected you to. I am now encountering something I'm not prepared for. The job of parents, as Christian parents must surely understand, is to be out in front of these challenges, not behind them. We should be thankful these teenagers are going to their parents, and an uptick in that activity can only lead to better ends. But we also need to recognize that the fact they had to go to their parents, rather than their parents being aware already of what was going on in their digital lives, is evidence of a huge abdication of responsibility. We can only wonder how many Christian parents are included in these larger numbers of parents who abdicate that responsibility and had better seize it, and seize it fast. Changing the issue of our concern to memory, one of the things we need to recognize is that a part of being made in God's image is being given the gift of memory. Animals, other creatures, have a very rudimentary understanding of memory, if at all, very little capacity to recall because they simply do not have that kind of complex intelligence, but human beings do. And we need to recognize that as God made us, as the creature who remembers, some of these memories are encouraging and uplifting. Some of them are very positive. Some of them are the opposite. They are horrifying, they are tragic, and they are enslaving. And this leads me to a story that was published in Saturday's edition of the New York Times. The headline is this: Almost a year after the massacre, Newtown begins raising Sandy Hook. The article is very interesting from a theological and worldview perspective, even though the author of the article, the reporter James Barron, doesn't actually intentionally touch on those issues. And that's often the case. What we're looking at here is the fact that a town is dealing with a tragedy that is so out of scale in terms of its horror that it doesn't know, or at least didn't know, what to do with the school building where the horrible event took place. It was almost a year ago when 20 first graders and 6 employees were killed by a 20-year-old gunman. And now the city has decided to raise the school. They're going to destroy the school. Unlike the decision made by the town of Littleton, Colorado years ago with respect to Columbine High School, Those in Newtown, Connecticut just felt like they could no longer even go into the building ever again. There were warm memories, as many in the community remembered their own positive experiences in that elementary school. But the memory of the killing of 26 people in December of 2012, the memory of 20 children gunned down in cold blood by a 20-year-old alumnus of the school, was simply more than virtually anyone in the town was willing to handle going forward. As was explained as the city decided to raise the school, in order to remove this horrible memory, they're taking extraordinary steps. Legal arrangements which limit any kind of conversation on the part of those who are construction workers razing, destroying the site. They're going to pulverize the bricks so that no bricks can show up on eBay or out there in the market. They're going to destroy everything and melt down the steel. And all of this is going to be done in order not only to remove the building from the community's memory, but to do everything possible to make sure that there can be no item, not a single brick or a single piece of steel that survives the destruction of this school. Why would people in a community like this go to such an extent, to such an extreme, to try to remove a memory? Because there are memories we simply cannot forget. And we cannot walk into some places without the horrifying memory of what took place there. Thankfully, for most communities, there's nothing analogous to Sandy Hook Elementary School. But for most of us, there is some place, or there is some prompt to memory, that we simply have to avoid. In this case, Robert Mitchell, the chairman of Newtown's Public Housing and Site Commission, said, and I quote, "The bricks will be crushed beyond recognition. The steel will be melted, and nothing identifiable will be leaving this site," end quote. Well, this is an understandable act, but we also need to recognize that it will not accomplish all that the citizens of Newtown, Connecticut hope for. There will be no way, even if you remove every brick and every piece of steel, every vestige of that building, for the memories to be totally wiped away. This is why we have to await, as Christians, understanding the Christian worldview, for an eschatological satisfaction of all of our deepest needs, including our need, even as believers in Christ, to forget certain things we simply cannot forget. We come to the very end of the book of Revelation, and we are told that what Christ accomplishes in his eschatological victory means that every tear is wiped away and every eye is dry. Until then, it makes sense for us to try to avoid those things that bring us horrible memories. But at the end of the day, we can't run from them entirely. We know, we must know, and even those who are not Christians must know the longing for a reality and a cleansing and a healing that can only come from without and can only come from Christ. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.